your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. This has been a very eventful week, to say the least. We had a conclusion of the Electoral College process. I actually watched the counting of the electoral votes by a joint session of Congress, and Joe Biden, the Vice President of the United States, was presiding over the joint session as President of the Senate, but in this case he was presiding over the joint session. And then what would happen was a special committee that oversees the Electoral College votes was reading out at the podium the verification from the different states in alphabetical order. And then they would be handed over to a clerk and then certified into the congressional record as to the different votes from the different states. Well, during this process, you had several, you could say it looked like U.S. representatives, congressional representatives, probably from the Democratic side, tried to disrupt the proceedings and tried to inject into the process debate and so forth. Well, Joe Biden would say, do you have under Article 16 and 17, do you have a written, you know, number of people from the Senate and the House to provide the necessary debate platform procedures? And none of them did. And then he would gavel them to silence and continue on. Well, it got to the point where he got a little fed up with these instigations and disruptions. So he eventually he said, it's all over. He used three words, it's all over. And Paul Ryan, who was sitting in behind him on the podium up there, laughed. And then there was a clapping from primarily the Republican members of the joint session of Congress. But anyway, they did certify the vote, the Electoral College votes, and they did certify Trump as the winner of the national presidential race. Now, that doesn't exclude the time between now and the 20th. On the 20th, his inauguration. As I understand it, yesterday, he was actually certified and he became president, except for the inauguration. And the inauguration will be January 20th of this month. So we've got, today is the 7th of January, so we have about 13 more days before that happens. But anyway, that's ongoing, and it was very, very cantankerous and chaotic what was happening in that joint session. And the joint session are always held on the House side because of the number of seats and just the ability to accommodate, say, 100 senators and a few other members, you know, staff members and so forth. Well, that got done. Now, also, what's interesting about Trump as the president-elect and certified at this point is that he's circumventing the media by his Twitter. So what he's beginning to do is, what's happened, just like in religions where you have interpreters such as priests and so forth, begin to be interpreters of that religion, so too is happening with him. He's setting new precedents that are new and never before seen by a newly elected president or a president-elect or an incoming president, which he is already. But so he's breaking the mold, and in breaking the mold, he's upset a lot of people. It's amazing the number of people that were in an adversarial position against him, that were allied against him. And it's just, it means that he is not the world order that Kissinger will speak about later. I have a clip of him addressing the first annual Oslo Peace Forum in Oslo, Norway. He and Dr. Brzezinski both spoke. But he talked about the world order. And this is upsetting to the world order, which are your richest people in the Western, you could say, civilized areas in the West. So they meet, you know, at Bilderberg meeting once a year. Kissinger is always there. But anyway, getting back to this, his Twitter, excursions, you could say, and comments are unsettling to a lot of people because they lose their ability to interpret and to massage and bend and manipulate his words. Getting on to our number three item here on our list today for this program this evening, the Syrian situation is continuing. Just recently, you've seen a coming together of Turkey along with Russia in trying to attain some kind of a peace initiative and trying to initiate some beginnings that might be fruitful. You've always had the rebels there that were supported by the United States, and especially Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It's been proven now that Obama and Hillary Clinton were in full support and created ISIS. That's just a fact, and they can't get out of that. So in creating ISIS, they gave it a new name, but they didn't want to call it Al-Qaeda, see. But they've been doing all the big troublemakers over there. And so today, that's ongoing. It's unpredictable. Turkey has only come around recently because of their military coup last summer that he overcame. The Erdogan has come back with a very, very strong reaction and started jailing people. He's jailing media, journalists. He's jailing a lot of military. He's after a lot of other military and so forth. And he hasn't stopped his scourge of purging, you could say, of his so-called enemies. That has given him a motivation to look to Russia as more of an ally than an adversary in the past, like he had in the past. Plus, he's right across the Black Sea from Russia also. So, well, there's Ukraine, the Crimea now is controlled by Russia. So he is right across the Black Sea from the Crimea, and then you've got Ukraine right there north of that, adjacent to it. So it's getting interesting, and when Russia came in there and started helping the Syrian government, that was a master stroke. Now, on other types of going-ons in this country is that you've had all kinds of problems, okay, with this Russian this assertion by our so-called military-industrial intelligence complex, or you could say the intelligence complex, I guess, led by Clapper now, that and they just recently testified before Congress that there was some interference by the Russians. But in their recent report, you're not going to find that to be so. And that's why right now I'm going to play a little over a 5-minute clip by John McAfee. He's the founder originally of the McAfee antivirus, but also he sold that off in the past. But also he knows a lot about the media. He knows a lot about internet, web. He knows about hacking and so forth. And so forth. And I'm going to play that clip right now to give you some idea of what kind of a put-up job this thing is about the Russians hacking the election. And it's fake to a large extent. And they were just put forward by Obama and Hillary to confuse people and try to throw disrupt the ongoing completion of Trump going into the White House. Anyway, I want to let you listen to that right now.
Despite the recent allegations against Russia, the FBI never accessed the hacked servers of the DNC in their investigation. For more on the hearing, I'm joined tonight by John McAfee, cybersecurity legend and developer of the McAfee antivirus, and also the CEO of MGT. Great to have you with us tonight, John. I appreciate your time. Characterize what you heard today on Capitol Hill. How conclusive is it?
Well, I'm going to be very frank with you and the American public. I think that today, the most deceptive propaganda to date was perpetrated on the American public. The data that was presented, the evidence, was culled from a thing called the Grizzly Step Report, put together jointly by Homeland Security and the FBI. In there are four facts which they claim prove that Russia did this hack. It was utter nonsense. The information was, number one, Russian language was found in the malware. Number two, a Cyrillic keyboard was used. By the way, the forensic science can now tell what type of keyboard was used to develop a piece of malware. Number three, the compiler, that is one of the piece of software that compiles the code so that it can execute, always dates and timestamps. It said that the timestamps were in a time zone for the business hours of Moscow and St. Petersburg and other places in Russia. And then number four, that the IP address pointed to a Russian address. Now, let me go through this and try to make it very simple for the American people. If the CIA wanted to hack Russia, the things you would not do is you would not include the English language in your software, because that would then exclude everybody except English-speaking nations. You would certainly not use a keyboard that everybody knows that the CIA uses, whatever keyboard they use. You'd have them use a Chinese keyboard or something else. You would certainly remove the date and time stamp from the program so that you couldn't tell what business hours or what zone you were in when it was compiled. And number four, you would absolutely not have an IP address that points to you. Because, seriously, if Russia declared war on us because we hacked Russia, and the head of the CIA or the intelligence committee came to Congress and they said, what happened? Oh, well, you know, we didn't have time to remove the English language. We didn't have time to remove the date stamp. We didn't have time. The guy that couldn't use the Chinese keyboard, so we gave him our regular keyboard. And, you know, it was my wife's birthday, so I could not remove the IP address. Please. Yeah. That person would be scheduled for suicide. So this is what
John,
they are asking
does,
us. Yes.
Does Donald Trump have enough room to challenge this? I mean, the way you present it tonight, this doesn't sound credible. It doesn't sound conclusive. It sounds rather flimsy the way you've presented it.
Well, it's not just flimsy. It's either this. It's propaganda intended to incite the American people to anger toward Russia for some reason, or our intelligence community is so ignorant and naive that they should all be replaced. And here's the kicker. Here is why it cannot possibly be an organized nation state. Because the hack on the DNC used a piece of malware a year and a half old, and there have been many updates since then. Do you actually believe the Russian intelligence services spend all their time improving their malware, and then when you do an important attack, go, well, I used that thing from a year ago, it only had a few bugs? No. This was done by an independent one-person kid that downloaded the software. And by the way, the software came from two different organizations they're claimed to be two different organizations that are related to the Russian government. That's absolutely false. They're called APT-28 and APT-29, and those designations come from FireEye, people who watch all the hacking groups. In truth, it's only one organization, and it's composed not just of Russians, but of people, kids all around the world. You can go on the dark web, download the software, hack somebody, and so this kid had obviously downloaded it a year and a half ago and had not bothered to update it. Please, this is not an organized hack, and certainly not a nation state that did this.
John McAfee, great to have you with us tonight. Thanks for your expertise here on the news. I appreciate it so much.
Okay, we're back after that. And did you see the 4 points that he made? Is that hackers that are any good, and unless, especially state actors and so forth, someone that's working for a deep intelligence agency that's got people that are doing hacking, they're going to cover their tracks. And I think John McAfee said it real well in a lot of different ways, but he did explain the technical part of it fairly well. But we've had all these this recent hearing now, and you have John McCain that was the chairman of this recent committee that listened to Clapper and so forth. But John McCain has little credit in my book. He turned his back along with John Kerry on the POW question in September of 1992. He did a disservice to our vets, and he stopped the process of trying to bring the remaining POWs home, which there were many at that time, and many probably have died since then. So John McCain and John Kerry, they have no credibility in my book. They turned their back on the POW question in September 1992. Captain Eugene Red McDaniel tried his best to try to start a process, and other people. Bill Hendon wrote a book called An Enormous Crime, and I would recommend that highly. But anyway, so this Russian assertion, there's you know, that they assert that this Russian came in and manipulated the elections and so forth and so on. In my way of thinking, it's a put-up job. It's propaganda. It's coming out of this administration. You can't trust them to say the truth. And Hillary is also in the same category. Now, getting on to some other topics, we recently had last month, in Oslo, okay, on December 11th, the day after the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway, there's some information here that's good to know, is that the Peace Prize is awarded in Oslo, Norway, but the Peace Prizes, the Nobel Peace Prizes, are actually Swedish in origin, okay, Alfred Nobel. They were created from a bequest that he left. And all but the Nobel Peace Prize are awarded in Stockholm. Only the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded in Oslo. And that's because Sweden and Norway were at peace at that time. And so as a goodwill gesture, the Swedes allowed the Norwegians to present and to award the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway. So you have a committee there that in Norway that decides on who's to receive that. See, well, anyway, that was recently awarded to a Colombian, Juan Manuel Santos, for ending a 50-year civil war in Colombia, and that was quite an achievement to overcome that civil war status. Anyway, but what followed that the next day was what they call the Oslo Peace Forum, and it was the first inaugural peace forum there. And they had invited Dr. Brzezinski along with Henry Kissinger to speak. And I have up on the website of The Secret Truth, you can come in there and you can click off and listen to the whole presentation, which is about an hour and 40 minutes long. I have short clips here. The first clip I have is Henry Kissinger speaking about some of the problems of peace in the near future, in the long-term future. So let me let you listen to that right now.
The title assigned to this event, the USA and world peace after the presidential election, can be interpreted in two ways. To call attention to the appearance of a new and heretofore unfamiliar American president, or to use the end of the American electoral process as a reference point for reflection on the nature of peace. Let me say a word about both interpretations. No doubt. The president-elect is a personality for whom there is no precedent in modern American history. And his campaign included rhetorical elements, challenging patterns, heretofore considered traditional. But before postulating an inevitable crisis, an opportunity should be given to the new administration to put forward its vision of international order. The international debate should be over evolving American policy, not over campaign rhetoric. By the same token, the new administration, as it seeks to take the country from where it is to where it has never been, will confront unavoidable aspects of leadership. The exploration of heretofore undiscovered possibilities has inevitable limits in the technical possibility and in the claims of the historic. The choice is not between the ideal and the real, but in their synthesis. In that spirit, I will concentrate my remarks on the structure of peace facing the new administration, not on speculation of what it may or may not undertake. Is peace to be identified with the ending of specific wars? Or is the ultimate goal of peace to establish and maintain a structure of international order? In 1973, when I first encountered the Nobel Prize institutionally, the word peace meant ending of the Vietnam War as a prelude to forging a set of workable relationships among the nuclear powers, which could bring the Cold War to an end and shepherd into existence an enduring peace. In time, these objectives were more or less achieved. The Vietnam War ended, first by agreement, ultimately by conquest. And the Cold War did come to an end. By the 1990s, a new structure of global peace seemed to be emerging. In America, there was talk of a peace dividend. In 1989, a widely discussed article titled "Its Inquiry and Whether We Had Arrived at the End of History" with a question mark. When the book with the same title was published in 1992, the question mark had disappeared. Today, a quarter of a century after the end of the Cold War, what does peace signify? In one sense, it is the globalization of the European concept of world order. Europe's unique contribution to the concept of peace goes beyond an armistice between warring states to institutions and rules which moderate the fluctuations of history with structural requirements. No other civilization has undertaken a comparable enterprise. Three general principles formed it: international law, the balance of power, and the concept of sovereignty. The horrors of the 30 Years' War led the Dutch jurist diplomat Grotius to produce one of the world's most consequential books, The Law of War and Peace, inaugurated the concept of international law and set rules to the conduct of states. International law was reinforced by the evolution of the concept of the balance of power, which strove to maintain international order in such a way that a quest for hegemony always faced exorbitant risks. Legitimacy would curb the desire to upset the international system, and the balance of power would foil the capability to do it. By the turn of our century, a rules-based system had come into being to peoples everywhere. Its symbolic expression has been the UN General Assembly of over 190 sovereign nations. Unfortunately, the structural basis of the international system is now under stress, and it has deteriorated largely because of the actions of its own membership. It has become fashionable to declare the existing world order as outmoded and national sovereignty as a concept whose time has passed. In the age of instant communications, the concept of soft power has emerged as a retreat from the balance of power and from the enforcement mechanisms of the international order. In these conditions, extreme nationalism has grown, paradoxically, as an alternative global system. A kind of isolationism has emerged, leaving the rest of the world to fend for itself, for better or for worse. The rejection of the international system finds its most challenging expression in a radical religious ideology used to justify the most extreme uses of violence to serve its effort to replace the state by a universal caliphate. Finally, in many areas of the world, the rules-based system is under attack as a product of the West, and therefore as an alien imposition. These trends are threatening the modern state system. Unilateral action is on the rise. Sovereign borders are becoming ambiguous, ignored, or violated. The equality of states is beginning to yield to regional hierarchies. The fear of a nuclear weapons conflagration eased with the end of the Cold War and the achievement of treaty obligations that would reduce nuclear arsenals and strengthen non-proliferation. Now, however, loose nukes, rhetoric about tactical nuclear use, the modernization and miniaturization of weapons, ever greater missile ranges, and the apparent acceptance of new threshold nuclear powers all have put the established structures for international decision at risk of being overwhelmed. Vast humanitarian disasters are occurring, notably in Syria and Africa. The parlous condition of the international system is symbolized by the latent competition between four visions of world order: the European, Westphalian, the Islamic, the Chinese, and the American. Consequently, none enjoy universal acceptance. Each model is tempted to maneuver for regional or global advantage. A struggle between regions could be even more destructive than the struggle between nations has been. By the same token, four scenarios emerge as possible catalysts of large-scale conflagration and as subjects for the quest for peace. First, a deterioration of Sino-American relations, whereby the two countries tumble into the so-called Thucydides trap, which history has said for every incumbent power and the rising power challenging it. Second, a breakdown of relations between Russia and the West, growing out of the paradox of mutual incomprehension between parallel cultures. Third, a continuing weakening of European strategic relevance because of Europe's loss of a sense of global mission. And fourth, an escalation of conflict of the Middle East in a competitive quest for hegemony between Sunni Arab states, revolutionary Iran, and outside powers taking one side or the other. These are the challenges the American president will confront in seeking to achieve international peace together with like-minded global leaders. Much of the contemporary discussion stresses the overriding role of the national interest. And indeed, foreign policy has to begin with a clear understanding of the national interest. At the same time, in our interconnected world, the national interest must be connected with and limited by a vision of world order. In particular, technologically advanced countries need to develop joint ways to limit the impact of their scientific effort on each other and the world. The United States, China, and Russia have a special obligation as the most developed advanced weapons arsenal to prevent nuclear weapons from becoming conventional. They must not acquiesce in their use in the hands of third countries to which proliferation has been tolerated. Of special concern must be the evolution of artificial intelligence into machines capable of autonomous self-learning and autonomous communication, potentially making humanity the victim of its own inventions. Is it conceivable that the originators of colonialism will wind up being colonized by their own technological creations? At the core of many of these issues is the ambiguity of what constitutes the legitimate entity on which order is to be based. Is that unit still the state? Should it be? If not, what is the procedural basis for a new international order? The overriding virtue of the present order is that no equally inclusive alternative system is available. The deepest challenge in our period is to adapt the existing world order or to renovate it. For on the other side of the existing structure, chaos looms. For America, this would require a recognition that the world faces not so much a specific crisis as a tectonic shift to the global structure. For China, that eminence is to some extent both relative and conditional. For Russia, that the respect it seeks must allow for truly sovereign structures along its extended borders. And for Europe, that diversity is a circumstance, but policy needs a sense of direction, indeed, a vision. The statesman will forever be tempted by the pressures of the moment to set aside his obligations to the world's long-term future. But his calling offers as well insight into perils unprecedented in the history of mankind. Drift will multiply their complexities. In the 18th century, Immanuel Kant predicted the coming of universal peace, either by human insight or by catastrophes of such magnitude that no other choice remained. This prospect has grown only more stark in the intervening centuries. A last personal word. As an immigrant, I came to know America as a beacon of hope for the oppressed. As a soldier, I saw America's role in overcoming the scourge of war against world order. At university, I reflected about the impacts of the lessons of history on the exceptional circumstances of America. As a consultant and policymaker, I have had the honor to participate in various ways in America's permanent quest for a structure of peace. Some hopes were unfulfilled. A few proved unrealizable, even counterproductive. But the overriding quest for peace and stability has dominated every American presidential administration I have studied and known. Many of the contemporary structures of peace have had either American support or American origin. I hope and believe that in the decades ahead, the United States will continue to fulfill its history and tradition of building world peace. Thank you for this opportunity.
Okay, we're back. Well, Henry had a lot to say, and some of the words that he used that were interesting was world order. See, now what when Brzezinski and Kissinger's and other foreign policy advisors and so forth go out and speak to public, it's good to listen to what they have to say because there is meaning and force behind their words. They're not only setting policy or reflecting what the policy is at the time or the recent past, you could say, and projecting into the future. But also, they're mind-boggling and continuing the feedings of an intellectual mindset that you have that swirls around foreign policy decision-making in the world. Okay? And so, they're feeding. When I say feeding, it's like brainwashing and mind control is what these people are practicing, but from a very, very high level. The people that are listening to these people and taking their advice are mesmerized by their great stature and so forth. But they're not under the idea or even accepting an idea that they're being manipulated and used at the time by their words, see. But anyway, he went on to say that this Trump administration is new and it's unsure and untried. But the thing is that the world order is not wanting to accept Trump in the White House. He's not a player yet. What they've done with these appointments is they surrounded him with as many of the world players that they control through a money system. And that's where the money dominance is the biggest thing. It controls and manipulates and dominates from a money power, okay? And you gotta say the city of London and New York and Frankfurt and all these, and Hong Kong and Singapore, all these big money centers, they do a tremendous amount to control. But, Kissinger had some interesting things to say. And actually, he said that we're in a dangerous area now. He went on to say about nuclear, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and that we're into a regional war footing, possibly versus nation states fighting. We have some kind of a regional thing. But that's setting it up for what Brzezinski says next. And I'm going to play that clip right now of Dr. Brzezinski speaking at the Oslo Peace Forum.
Consequently, the three principal shareholders of global power are now less inclined to resort to nuclear provocations. But caution and collaboration must prevail between the United States, China, and Russia if a fundamental conflict is to be avoided. for Russia, the regional situation has become increasingly difficult. Former non-Russian members of the Soviet Union, as you well know, are now openly asserting their own national independence and refusing to participate in any structure evocative of the deceased Soviet Union. The Central Asian republics, mostly of Islamic faith, have become determined to translate their initially nominal independence into genuine statehood. Their aspiration is also shared by such Slavic and Russian Orthodox states as Ukraine and Belarus, both of which are now committed to separate statehood, their own flag, armed forces, and closer links to Europe. In the meantime, China's strategic penetration of Central Asia in order to gain direct commercial access to Europe is already prompting a significant reduction of Russia's economic domination of the eastern portion of the former Soviet Union. Currently, China's relationship with Russia seems to offer Beijing a somewhat more attractive short-term alternative, though both sides have historical grievances that make each suspect the intentions of the other. This is why the ambitious Chinese initiative of OBOR, One Belt, One Road, in Central Asia, has produced some uneasiness in Moscow, which has been cautiously encouraging a local slowdown in the development of China's planned commercial outreach all the way to Europe. In the longer run still, for Russia, the most ominous of all may be the spreading hope among some Chinese military leaders that China will eventually regain the huge spaces of the far eastern Siberian areas acquired forcibly in the mid-1800s by Tsarist Russia. The distant and basically unpopulated extremities of Asia, just look at the map, could thus become the long-run focus of China's vision of its geopolitical restoration. And please note that China today numbers 1.4 billion people. Russia today, as a national state, numbers 144 million people. The disproportion is almost staggering. In any case, Russia is faced with an increasingly complex relationship with both China and the United States, which inevitably constrains its long-range ambitions. Its aspirations can only be realized if Russia, disabused of the idea of continental supremacy, evolves ultimately into a leading player in Europe itself. At the same time, it needs to be acknowledged that America's policy towards China has become more ambiguous and lacking in a shared strategic vision, a shared strategic vision with China, that was so characteristic a decade or two ago of the increasingly cordial relationship between Washington and Beijing. The U.S. must be wary of the great danger that China and Russia could form a strategic alliance generated in part by their own internal political and ideological momentum, and in part by the poorly thought-out policies of the United States. The U.S. should not act towards China as if it were already an enemy. Significantly, it should not favor India as America's principal ally in Asia. This would almost guarantee a closer connection between China and Russia. Nothing is more dangerous to the United States than such close connection.
Okay. Brzezinski has some very, very interesting points to make. And what he does is that he says that the most dangerous thing for the United States, they have, there's a concept called the heartland. And the heartland comprises Eastern Europe and Asia. Okay. And one of the precepts of geopolitical thought that came about at the turn of the last century was that whoever controls the heartland rules the world. So if the ultimate rule would be by China, India, and Russia. If those three came together, they would rule the world. If China and Russia came together, they would rule the world. So in Brzezinski's presentation at the Oslo Peace Forum just recently, last month, he says that that's the most dangerous thing that could ever happen in the United States if Russia and China came together. That's why we've got to be careful in not alienating Russia and turning them into an adversary versus some kind of a detente or a peace here. So, and then Brzezinski also said some things about the Baltic states of Estonia, Lithuania, and also he mentioned Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad Oblast is a Russian state. You could say it's not physically, you know, connected to Russia proper. But recently, Putin has moved nuclear weapons into that area, and also Obama and his Pentagon have been moving weapons, and along with NATO, they've been moving into Poland and in those areas right up against the Baltic states. So Brzezinski's a hardliner too in this respect, that he says that if Russia does any mischief making in the Baltic states area, he would advise the West to conduct a blockade of their maritime shipping. Are you kidding me? That's an act of war. Brzezinski has always been on the liberal left, socially and so forth, with the Democrats. But he's hard-lined against Russia. We cannot take a hard line now. We've got to keep Russia and China apart. And their mischief-making in the Eastern European area, in Eastern Poland, which is right in that area of the Baltic states. So they're setting up some kind of it could be a false flag operation or something, or an incitement or provocation of the Russians to do something on a regional basis there, or in Ukraine also by festering that wound, by feeding that, by picking at a festering wound in the Ukraine. So these are two hot spots that the geopolitical people are looking at. And then in addition to this, Brzezinski says the Northeast Asia area, northeast Siberia, above Mongolia, above China, is an area that the Chinese are going to move into or wanting to dominate eventually. And so that's something to look at that also. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed both of those. Now let's get back to the Pizzagate. It's very, very true. The Pizzagate, it's not hype. They invented this fake news concept to go against and to lash out at and to try to punish and to categorize and portray those alternative news sites that are still covering the Pizzagate as false news sites, see. Now, earlier years ago in the 80s, when there was also a pedophilia outbreak and scandal in California, they used this false memory as a system to go against or to provide a defense mechanism of pedophile accused people in courts of law. And what they said there with that false memory was the children undergoing these kind of events or so-called trauma or whatever, you know, alleged trauma, couldn't remember those events properly or accurately. And that was to cover the event as being real. But anyway, that's something we've got to cover. Now, the fake news of the Poynter Institute down in Florida was mentioned, and it came out of a newspaper chain by the Poynters, and there was the father started a newspaper chain and turned it over to his son, whose wife Henrietta Poynter is mentioned in the Who's Who in 1968. It was a publication by an East German, and it listed all the proposed it was a list of who's who in the CIA. Now, how accurate that is, we don't know. The Poynters during World War II did a bang-up job in Hollywood in trying to get propaganda into the movies that was pro-West, pro-American, and pro-British against the Nazis. And so I'm not saying that they're bad people. I'm just saying that there's great connection here, possibly of Henrietta Poynter to the CIA. We know Alan Dulles was running Project Mockingbird out of Washington, D.C., which was a manipulation of many of our top newspaper journalists and reporters by the CIA post-World War II. So we don't know if Henrietta Poynter was a CIA agent or not, but it's something to look into. A lot has been going on here. We've got to look at this carefully. The Pizzagate is an international scandal. The Jimmy Savile in Britain is a way to tie that in there also. So these are real people. These are real children, too, that are being hurt. And really, I mean, there are terrible things that are occurring to these young children. They're being kidnapped and tortured and executed and initiated, you know, all these initiations and sacrifices and stuff. This is real. Jim Rothstein has a story to tell as a detective for well over 25 years in the New York City area. And he says that about 70% of your elite people in the political arena are pedophiles, is in his opinion. And he was on a task force that was charged with going after these kinds of charges against people. And so he had a lot of experience. He's a gold badge detective out of New York City. He did consulting work all over the world in this area. So he's somebody to listen to. So I think Jim Fetzer had him on one of his programs recently. So look up Jim Fetzer and Jim Rothstein. And listen to this Jim Rothstein. He's a very fine stand-up individual. His word is beyond reproach. His integrity is beyond reproach. And he's just a really fine gentleman and detective. And he's dedicated there for years and years in the New York City area. We want to thank everybody for listening out there. Oh, we'll have the click offs are up on our site now. Our second hour will be will follow here shortly with Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. So stay tuned in to listen to Tony Gosling and myself talking about different issues and topics all over the world. But again, thank you for listening, and God bless everyone. And by gosh, we can't give up the fight. We've got to continue to keep on trucking, and don't stop and never look back, and just let those enemies eat your dust. But thank you so very much for listening, and we'll be back next week, 7 to 9, here in Austin.